Today, how much of a gamble is Boris Johnson's Christmas election? And, in opinion, Guy Standing on how to better share out the wealth from natural resources. The Conservatives are far enough ahead of Labour in the opinion polls that in normal times they would be heading for a healthy majority after the election in December.
There we see a clear 13-point Conservative lead over Labour.
But these times are anything but normal. If 2017 was a two-horse race, 2019 could be very different.
A general election on December the 12th.
We always said we wanted an election. We do want an election.
With the rise of the Lib Dems.
We have more members than ever before.
SNP and Brexit Party.
Scotland can deprive the Tories of a majority.
Splitting hundreds of seats three, four or even five ways.
What kind of people do we want to represent us in Parliament?
Experts say that fragmentation on this scale has never happened before.
Seat by seat, tactical voting, just one reason why this election is so hard to predict.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, Boris Johnson's election gamble. Boris Johnson probably could have got a version of his Brexit deal through this parliament with a bit more time. But from the moment he was elected leader, Downing Street's focus seems to have been on an election. Why is that? And why, until recently, did the opposition resist it?
He has always known that he was going to need a proper majority. It's very difficult to get anything done in a hung parliament.
Heather Stewart is The Guardian's political editor.
So his Downing Street has always been run as a kind of campaign operation. You know, he's out visiting hospitals practically every day. Every government announcement is tailored to different groups of voters. There's lots of kind of handing out little bits of money to different constituencies so Tory MPs can say, look what goodies I've brought you. The SNP and the Lib Dems, who are the most ardently Remain parties, have seen the best route to stopping Brexit as securing a referendum until fairly recently. But it's become increasingly clear that there isn't the majority, or there's very unlikely to be the majority in Parliament for that.
And for Labour?
So Labour have been split on this. Jeremy Corbyn and some of his close advisers have been quite keen, I think, for a while to go to the polls.
We are ready for an election. We're going to go out there with a very strong message of how we transform our society.
They think he benefits from being out there on the campaign trail. They don't like being stuck in a kind of hung parliament. However, there's another group who felt that maybe there was still a chance to secure that referendum, or maybe the best thing to do was to try and improve the Brexit deal, try and amend it, maybe get a closer relationship with the EU out of it.
I think it's fair to say that Boris Johnson must think that he's going to win. But the thing that everyone is talking about is volatility and whether this could be a gamble for him.
What's clear is that this will be one of the most volatile and unpredictable elections we've ever had.
Any one pollster, Matt Singh, suggested that the only conventional wisdom when it comes to this snap election is we have no idea. And in an Observer article, the academic Rob Ford said all bets are off. Why is it so unpredictable?
So part of it is Brexit, which cuts across both main parties, I think, splits their support to some extent. The Brexit party's nipping at Boris Johnson's heels. The Liberal Democrats are casting a shadow over Labour's hopes. But it's also just lack of the long-term party loyalties that used to characterise British politics for a very long time. So just to chuck one fact in to illustrate that, the British election study shows you that across the three general elections, 2010 to 2017, 49% of people didn't vote for the same party across those three elections.
And it's not just people who've been switching parties over the past few years. Yeah. MPs have been doing it too.
I'm not leaving the Conservative Party. It's left us.
I suspect that those who are going to be most critical of the decision that I have made will be many of those that I left behind in the Labour Party.
How can I possibly continue with the Conservative whip?
This morning, we have all now resigned from the Labour Party.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's another sign of this sort of volatility or this sort of reshaping of politics that we've seen.
As well as all the factors you've touched upon, the other thing making people like us wary about making predictions is 2017. We covered that together here, and I remember very clearly the day Theresa May stood behind the Downing Street podium with people saying she'd bag a majority of 100 because of a massive poll lead against a divided Labour Party, whose leader, Jeremy Corbyn, had a net satisfaction rating of minus 42. As we all know, in fact, she lost her majority.
And what we're saying is the Conservatives are the largest party. Note, they don't have an overall majority at this stage.
Were the polls just wrong, or did something huge change during the campaign?
Yeah, a lot changed. So the received wisdom had always been that the campaign doesn't make a great deal of difference. Things didn't tend to move very much. But actually, she ran a dreadful campaign. They had a not very successful manifesto. And on the flip side, the public hadn't had a great deal of time to really look at Jeremy Corbyn. He'd only been Labour leader for about a year. And actually, he was energised and off he went and, you know, addressed these great cheering rallies.
Let us be together and recognise another world is possible if we come together to understand that, understand the power we've got and achieve that decent, better society where everyone matters.
And managed to sort of win people over. I think that kind of taught us that what you think may be the frame or the narrative for the campaign at the outset is not necessarily how it looks with hindsight.
I mean, people talked about that election as marking a return to two-party politics because Tories and the Labour between them got over 80% of the vote. But wasn't a big part of what happened that May attracted the Leave vote and that Corbyn attracted the Remain vote and the Lib Dems and UKIP at the time were massively squeezed. In the European elections this year, that reversed because people on both sides of the Brexit debate started to feel betrayed. Does that change things this time round?
Well, it's really hard to know. So part of what happens during a general election campaign is that people are thinking, who's going to be the government? Who's going to be the prime minister? And sometimes that can squeeze out the smaller parties and that might happen again. But, you know, we're 2 years of sort of parliamentary stasis on. So if people put Remain or Leave at the top of their list of priorities, perhaps the Brexit Party or the Liberal Democrats might do quite well. If, on the other hand, people are thinking more about domestic priorities, about tax and spend.
At the moment, there is cash available.
About hospitals.
The spending pledges have come thick and fast in this leadership. And today it was the turn of the NHS.
About schools.
And I've got an announcement to make, which is that we are putting a lot more money into schools, you'll be pleased to know. And the announcement is it is £14 billion.
All those kinds of things, you know, maybe the main parties do dominate.
OK, well, let's have a think about some of those points. With all the kind of lessons that we've learnt from 2017 and previous elections, let's start with Boris Johnson. Is there a chance that he could do a Theresa May and mess up this campaign?
Well, so on the manifesto, which was quite a big part of that, no, I don't think so. I do think actually that although Boris Johnson is a very seasoned campaigner, I do think he's quite a volatile person. I think you see that sometimes in the House of Commons. He sometimes gets irked. He gets a bit belligerent.
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I'm not going to take any lectures from anybody in the Labour Party about how they run their party. Look, this is a party where MPs, good, hard-working MPs, are daily hounded out.
I just think it's not impossible that he won't be quite so attractive to the public as he hopes, and you'll see a side of him that's not so appealing.
And while I reckon a lot of people do love Boris Johnson, and I've been out watching him campaigning, and it's amazing how he can kind of attract supporters from other parties.
To take back control. Take back control of huge sums of money. Of huge sums of money.
Some of the stuff that he says people love, like I suspect when he says man up or girly swat, you know, you and me, Heather, probably don't love it, but a lot of people probably do quite like that. But he is also really disliked, isn't he, as the head of a very divisive Brexit campaign. Do you think there could be an anti-Johnson vote?
Yeah, I certainly think it won't do the Conservatives any good in some of those Remain constituencies which the Liberal Democrats are hoping to take, where I don't think Boris Johnson is particularly the kind of Conservative that's likely to appeal there. And it also means he's quite easy to sort of stereotype for Labour, who'll want to say, you know, he's part of the establishment, he's posh, he's a toff, he went to Eton. I don't know how much of that will stick, but they'll certainly have a good go.
And in many ways, they are basically going for the same strategy as 2017. They're going after white working class communities who have long backed Labour but voted for Brexit.
How do you feel about the identification of Workington Man as the key to the general election?
And tell me what the Workington Man is.
This was some research by the Conservative think tank Onward, who said the Tories need to try and get a sort of swathe of seats across what they called rugby league towns among kind of working class voters who may not have been to university, men, white men very often, who may feel quite strongly about Brexit and may not have voted Tory before.
Do you think they've got a chance with them?
Yeah, I do think they've got a chance with them. I think, you know, if you look from a distance, I mean, and even if you look from up close sometimes, to be honest, Parliament has not done a good job of doing what the public asked it to do in 2016. There's absolutely no doubt about that. So if you were someone who felt quite strongly that you should get on with Brexit, you would feel probably quite frustrated with the Labour Party, for example. One question I don't know the answer to is how Boris Johnson will be viewed for failing to meet this promise. You remember he's kept saying it was a key part of his...
I think he was going to be dead in a ditch, wasn't he?
He'd rather be dead in a ditch.
I'd rather be dead in a ditch.
Than not leave the EU today, 31st of October, even though actually it's been clear for a while it wasn't going to happen or it was very unlikely to happen. So I don't know the answer to this. Do voters hold him responsible for that? Or has he been successful enough at showing that it's not really his fault? It's not me, Gov. I don't know.
Let's talk about Labour. One thing that went in their favour last time was a very radical manifesto. This time, Boris Johnson is going to have eye-catching policies. What are Labour going to do? Are they going to be even more radical?
Well, that's a really interesting debate that is going to have to happen, and it's going to happen very quickly. So at Labour's conference in Brighton last month, you saw quite a few really radical policies passed on the conference floor that have sort of bubbled up from the grassroots, often from sort of young members who joined to support Jeremy Corbyn. So on a Green New Deal.
We're here outside Labour conference, which has just passed a radical Green New Deal.
On migration, very open migration policy, on hashtag abolish Eton, as the policy was called.
Labour adopted perhaps one of the more controversial policies in its history, the effective abolition of private schools.
Some of these policies are very radical and would shift the party significantly to the left.
And what about Brexit? There's obviously a lot in the Labour movement who want to see Jeremy Corbyn take a much more forthright Remain position. He would argue, it's really quite simple what we're offering you. We're offering you a second referendum. And if you want to remain in a Labour Tory marginal, you're going to have to vote Labour. How do they deal with this?
I think that's right. And my goodness, it's been a sort of long road. But I think the position that they've arrived at is if you want a referendum to reverse the 2016 Brexit decision, you need to vote Labour, really. And the Lib Dems will say it's not enough. They'll say you don't mean it. And of course, Jeremy Corbyn has said, or has been made very clear, he's not going to say up front how he would campaign in that referendum, which Labour says it would hold within 6 months. And there are some members of the shadow cabinet. So John Trickett, I did an interview with recently, he said, if Labour negotiates a Brexit deal, I'd like to campaign for that. I'd like to campaign for a Labour Brexit. So you could say the party looks divided, but you could also say this is the one road left to stopping Brexit now that the referendum's not going to be brought about by this parliament.
One risk for Boris Johnson is whether the Labour Party wins over voters both by being radical in its policy, but also by being the path to Remain. But really, the reason that people are talking about volatility is that it's not all about Labour for Boris Johnson. There are three other pretty serious factors that stand in the way of a possible majority: the Brexit Party, the Liberal Democrats, and in Scotland, the SNP. They all make this incredibly unpredictable. Let's just take them one by one. Nigel Farage, leader of the Brexit Party, says that Johnson's deal is a treaty and that it's not as good as he would like to see in terms of a clean break.
If Boris Johnson decides to drop the treaty and we see the beginnings of a Brexit alliance fighting that election, it would win a thumping majority, and then we really would get Brexit done.
If that betrayal narrative picks up, what could that mean for the Tories?
Well, it could be a real problem for them, and the Brexit Party may manage to exploit this idea that Boris Johnson made this very firm promise that we'd be leaving on the 31st.
It will now take an accelerated timetable of work to get that done. And it may be that we have to come out without an agreement, if necessary, October the 31st.
It never happened. And my colleague Kate Proctor spoke to Richard Tice of the Brexit Party earlier this week, who was saying Conservative MPs are getting in touch with him and saying, please don't stand in my seat. So there are certainly concerns that even if the Brexit Party doesn't suddenly start putting MPs in Westminster, it could take enough votes away from the Tories to let the opposition parties through.
And one thing that's quite interesting about that is that Labour's polling has been suppressed by the Lib Dems doing quite well with their offer to revoke Article 50, a much clearer Remain offer. But it doesn't necessarily help Boris Johnson that they're suppressing Labour, because he has to fight Labour in some parts of the country and the Lib Dems in the other. I mean, how important could the Liberal Democrats be in stopping the Tories from getting their majority?
I think they could be quite important. And that a lot of the seats that the Lib Dems are targeting, they're Tory seats, because there are a lot of Tory Remainers. They're a small proportion of the Conservatives' electorate, but nevertheless, there are a lot of them. So Anne Main, who's the MP for St Albans Remain area, yesterday was saying in Parliament, for example, that she admitted that she was a bit of a mismatch with her seat. And Jo Swinson, the Lib Dem leader, said to her, "I've already been to St Albans and I plan to be spending a lot more time there."
"As a beautiful constituency, which I am already very familiar with, and I expect to be there more in the coming weeks."
So there are Tory seats that Boris Johnson looks quite likely to lose to the Remainy Lib Dems.
Which means he'd have to make even bigger gains than Theresa May in 2017.
Exactly. So Theresa May held on to all those sort of shire Tory seats in Remainy areas, and she was hoping to get those seats in the north. He has a deficit, as it were, because we're expecting him to lose quite a lot of those seats. Think about somewhere like Richmond in London. You know, very little chance of the Tories hanging on to that, you would think. So he needs to make up a lot of ground elsewhere.
And then there's Scotland. I mean, we've got Tory MPs up there in a country that voted Remain. They tend to be on the more moderate wing of the party, and they've lost a very charismatic leader in Ruth Davidson. How damaging could Scotland be for the Tories?
I think it could be incredibly damaging. The SNP have got the wind in their sails. They feel the argument for Scottish independence is considerably boosted by this sort of big change of Brexit and the fact that the Scots feel they haven't had a say. You know, it's, as you say, Scotland voted Remain. I'm not sure that Boris Johnson goes down terribly well north of the border. So I think they've got a big problem in Scotland, the Tories.
Okay, so all the things that you've been setting out, all these kind of potential moving parts in this election, whether it be what's happening in Scotland, whether the Lib Dems are going to pick up seats in the southwest, whether the Brexit Party is going to eat into Tory majorities, where they're taking on Labour, how Remainy Labour ends up being, what makes that add up into a particularly volatile system is that it all has to feed into first past the post. And that article I was mentioning by Rob Ford, the academic from Manchester University, suggested that we could literally have hundreds of seats where there are 3, 4, or 5 horse races. Our system really complicates this, doesn't it?
Yeah, it makes it extremely difficult to predict what's likely to happen and whether we're going to end up with any kind of governing majority at the end of all this, I think.
And in fact, our North of England editor, Helen Pidd, has really made that point in the areas that she's covering, saying this general election, very tough to call. I could see changes all over the north, e.g. Lib Dem gains from the Tories in Hazel Grove or Labour in Sheffield Hallam, Tory gains from Labour in Bishop Auckland or High Peak, Labour gains from the Tories in Calder Valley and Morecambe. But perhaps the biggest unknown that we've not touched on yet is the fact that it's going to be in December. And apparently the weather has an impact on elections.
Yeah, that's certainly what sort of election law tells you, is that turnout tends to be lower when it's raining, when it's dark. But it's certainly true that MPs are really not relishing the idea of going out campaigning in the cold and the dark. You know, it still means quite a lot of pounding the streets, quite a lot of knocking on doors. Those open air rallies that formed a sort of big part of Labour's 2017 campaign, a bit harder to pull those off if it's freezing cold, let alone pouring down with rain. So it'll have a very different character to it this election, I think.
Well, it was pretty wet in June 2017.
It was quite wet and sometimes quite chilly, that is true.
The other things we don't know about is whether the kind of changes we saw in 2017 are going to hold. For example, whether Labour will once again massively win the youth vote or whether the Tories can start to make gains there. Given the kind of complexity, given the fact that there are 650 very complicated races going on across the country, should we be paying attention to national polls? Or should we ignore them?
I think national polls can give you a bit of a sense of the direction of travel. So in 2017, it was clear as we went through that the Tory lead appeared to be narrowing. And that definitely told you something. And if we do start to get this squeeze that you do sometimes see, as we said, during general election campaigns, where the two main parties benefit, well, we should start to see that through the polls. But I do think all these cross-cutting issues mean that translating that into how many seats each party is going to get is extremely difficult.
Now, listen, given our chat, I'm not going to ask you for predictions.
Certainly
as I normally do.
It's a mugs game.
It's a mugs game, exactly. But tell me what different outcomes might mean for Brexit.
If Boris Johnson gets the majority that he hopes for, he will, as his slogan has it, get Brexit done.
Let's get Brexit done. We can, we must, and we will.
Or rather, he will implement the withdrawal agreement bill, which has his Brexit deal in it, and he'll then advance on the next stage of the Brexit negotiations, and we will see quite a loose future relationship with the EU. That's what he wants. He wants a free trade arrangement type deal, which is quite loose, doesn't tie us into a customs union or any of those things.
And he'll be in power until 2024 and able to deliver that.
Yeah, absolutely. If he gets a safe majority, the Fixed Term Parliaments Act, which has kept Theresa May and now him in power, despite the lack of a majority, which in the past would have seen you have to call an election months ago, that will keep him in place for 5 years.
And if it's a hung parliament?
And if it's a hung parliament, well, those small parties that we've been talking about could potentially have enormous power because the larger parties would be, presumably the Tories and Labour, unless we have a real earthquake, would be reaching out to them and saying, are there terms on which we could work together? So you can imagine, for example, a Labour government propped up in some way, perhaps not a formal coalition, but propped up in some way by the SNP, potentially, by the Lib Dems, potentially, if they could come to some sort of agreement about, most centrally, how to handle the Brexit issue, I think.
And if Labour get a majority?
If Labour get a majority, their plan on Brexit is to renegotiate a deal within 3 months, a sort of soft Brexit, off the shelf, soft Brexit, and within 6 months to put that to the public. And either we leave or we remain.
Heather, since you've been political editor, there's been a referendum and now two general elections. In your job, how are you going to cover this one?
Well, I'm looking forward to it. I'm excited, I should say, to start with. I'm an election nerd. I love elections. So I'm excited, perhaps not for the nation, but certainly it'll be fascinating to watch. So a lot of it means keeping very close tabs on what all of the parties are doing. So we tend to get these notes saying, could someone be on the 6:30 from King's Cross to wherever it happens to be? And off you go to join a rally or a campaign event. So my little team will be spreading out across the country and trying to keep tabs on what all the parties are doing.
Heather, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Heather Stewart. We can expect lots of brilliant reporting from her and her Westminster team over the next 6 weeks. Keep up with all of it on the website. Coming up, a radical economic manifesto about guarding our natural resources from the grip of private companies. Now, the economist Guy Standing argues that the commons, that is the natural resources once accessible to all members of society, need better protecting, and the wealth they generate should be shared by all of us.
I think it's important to understand what the commons are. They're the natural resources that belong to all of us, the land, the sea, the air, the water. And they were first enshrined in the Charter of the Forest and the Magna Carta in 1217. You can go through all of the aspects of the commons and you will see that there's been a systematic erosion, but it really accelerated with the arrival of Margaret Thatcher. Margaret Thatcher's view was that there's no such thing as society. And in a sense, what her guru, Friedrich Hayek, said was that things that don't have a price don't have any value. And that was an excuse to allow the privatization of our commons. I think the biggest scandal of all has been the privatization and colonization of our water system. Thatcher introduced that in 1989, and What has happened with the water companies, the regional monopolies that she created, is they loaded themselves up with debt, they've siphoned off all the profits to their foreign shareholders, and have not managed to maintain the water system or the sewage system. And worst of all, deliberately, those water companies have been pouring untreated sewage into our river systems and have been poisoning the rivers. Every single river in England is unsafe for drinking or swimming in. I and you have an equal right to the commons. And if you take the commons away, we should be compensated and first of all consulted before that happens. And what I propose is a charter of the commons and the establishment of a commons fund financed by levies on all commercial uses of what are or should be our commons. The only fair system of using that fund is to give every commoner, that means every resident citizen of this country, a dividend paid out of the fund, an equal dividend. And it's a form of basic income. We need to wake up to this dramatic erosion as quickly as possible. We value public spaces, we value our forests, we value our water, we value the air. And that is the primary thought behind the need for a charter of the commons for the 21st century that in a sense would mirror what the charter of the forest had been in 1217, that for generations after it was sealed and became part of our constitution had to be read out in every church in England four times a year. It was really that important, and we need an equivalent for the 21st century.
That was Guy Standing, a professor at SOAS, whose book, Plunder of the Commons, is out now. My thanks to Heather Stewart and Guy Standing. Today's episode was produced by Mytha Lee Rao, Gary Marshall and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.